Evelina Kako, greetings everyone. This is Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond, and I'm your host, Kehaulani Kawanui. Today's episode comes in two parts. First, we hear from Sherry Mitchell, who is the Executive Director of the Land Peace Foundation, which is based in Maine. The Land Peace Foundation provides low-cost legal assistance and alternative conflict resolution services to Indigenous nations, groups, and organizations in order to protect their human rights, homelands, sacred sites, natural resources, and cultural heritage. Second, I'll be speaking with Jamil Zbit'an and Zina Ozir about the Palestinian Right of Return Conference that will take place at the Boston University Law School Auditorium on April 6th and 7th, 2013. They'll be speaking to the ethical and practical implications of the Palestinian Right of Return. I'll tell you more about these topics and my guests, but first I want to let you know that this show focuses on the political struggles and resistance of Indigenous peoples. The program is produced in the studios of WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, a place also known as Mattabesset, homeland of the Wangunk Indian tribe. If you want to catch up on past episodes or share information about the show, you can go to my website for the audio archive. There you can listen at your convenience. That's at indigenouspolitics.com. I also administer a Facebook group by the same name as the program, Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond, and there you can follow global Indigenous news and get bulletins about upcoming episodes. And listeners can also write to me with feedback on the program. My email is indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. And now, turning to my first guest, Sherry Mitchell, the Executive Director of the Land Peace Foundation. She was born and raised on the Penobscot Indian Reservation, and received her J.D. and Certificate in Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy from the University of Arizona's James E. Rogers College of Law. Over the past 10 years, Sherry has worked as an educator for the Maine Attorney General's Civil Rights Division, as a law clerk at the United States Department of the Interior, Office of the Solicitor in Washington, D.C., as a law associate for a private practice in Boulder, Colorado, and as a legal analyst and advisor to Indigenous groups across the United States and Canada from her office in Tucson, Arizona. In 2009, her work on nation-state complicity with Indigenous human rights violations won her the Maloney Dunn International Human Rights and Humanitarian Award. She joins us by telephone from Old Town, Maine. Greetings, Sherry Mitchell. Are you on the line?
I am.
Thank you so much for taking time to join me on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. It's a pleasure to have you on the show, and I know you have an incredibly busy schedule, but I really want to ask you about this incredible work you're doing with Land Peace Foundation.
Well, it's an honor to be asked to be on the show with you, so thank you.
Could you start by telling our listeners some about your personal and professional background and how you came to found and become executive director and do this work on Indigenous rights?
Well, I'm a Penobscot tribal member, grew up on the Bunawabskik Reservation in central Maine along the Penobscot River to a family that was very active in working on Indigenous rights. In fact, my grandfather was the founder of the Wabanaki Center at the University of Maine and was instrumental in creating an educational center for Native students at the University of Maine, so I was kind of born into it.
Mm-hmm.
And spent much of my early life working on issues in the local area and kind of transferred that into work abroad because there's, I say abroad, I mean out in Indian country,
mm-hmm.
Because the issues are very similar for a lot of the tribes. And so when you're able to find a solution in one area, it often will work in another, not always, mm-hmm. certainly because each tribe is unique and has unique treaty agreements with the United States government. So, looking at ways that you can help maximize your ability to be of service to Indian people, there seemed to be a lot of places where that kind of made sense. And so I ended up doing work in a community development capacity for a long time and started getting into real advocacy work probably about 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And worked with Passamaquoddy Representative Donald Soctoma on his offensive language bill, worked with the Maine Attorney General's office and their Civil Rights Division addressing issues of racism, prejudice, bias crimes, education around the Maine Civil Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
And then ended up going to the University of Arizona, where I had the honor of working with James Anaya, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Rights, and Rob Williams, who literally wrote the book on federal Indian law,
mm-hmm.
and who has been doing incredible work on an international scale through the Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program there. And in between there, I got connected to a group called the American Indian Elders and Youth Circle.
Mm-hmm.
And as a part of that program, when I say program, it's not really the correct word for that, for it, it really is a gathering of elders and young people from across the country that come together every year to talk about the issues in Indian country and looking at them from a more spiritual perspective. And I had been a part of that circle since 1995.
Mm.
And so over the course of time, what occurred to me was that there were decisions that were being made in Indian country on a fairly regular basis that were detrimental to the people who were practicing Native spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And that those individuals, because they were not elected officials, did not have a voice at the table. And so one of the reasons for creating the Land Peace Foundation was to address that gap, because there's a lot that's being done by other organizations addressing tribal issues, but really seated in this kind of nation-to-nation relationship between the United States governments and the tribes, and that relationship is always with the elected officials.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the elected officials and the people who are doing other cultural or spiritual events in the community are at odds, then the voices of those cultural and spiritual individuals is often ignored.
Right.
And so we've worked very hard over the past 5 to 7 years to get them a voice at the table, the spiritual leaders. And so we've had some success. We have a group of elders who has been working on sacred sites protection, some religious freedom issues, really involved in the policy making process.
Mm-hmm.
They've been working with the National Forest Service, the USDA, Department of Interior, Department of Justice, being able to make comments into some of these policy making decisions, which is something that they had not had the opportunity to do in the past. And so that kind of was the impetus for us getting going.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a lot of things that kind of spiraled out of that, because there are a lot of people who, there's no shortage of work. So there's a lot of people who didn't have anybody to stand up with them. And so we've been trying to do what we can to stand up with those individuals to or groups to address some of the land rights issues. Most recently, that work has been in the Canadian Maritimes and in the state of Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot going on in those areas right now, as I'm sure you know, through the Idle No More movement. Some of the issues that are going on across Canada right now there's no other way to phrase them. These are issues of apartheid,
mm-hmm.
And genocide. It really is about the complete destruction of the status of, Aboriginal peoples in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's that ongoing ethnic cleansing and forced removal for the extraction of resources and ongoing land expropriation.
Exactly. Exactly. And right now, what's going on up there is that they have Harper's administration has created these tripartite agreements that essentially have the goal of changing the tribal people's status as Indigenous people into just, the same status as all Canadian citizens have, changing their communities into municipalities of Canada, extinguishing all of their treaty rights,
mm-hmm.
and any rights that they have as Aboriginal peoples under Canadian or international law, and lowering the threshold, essentially, to dispossess the peoples of their land.
Could you speak about that issue of the threshold, lowering the threshold, and issues of prior and free informed consent?
Yes. This is this is the heart of it right there. The Indian Act, which most people outside of Canada don't know what the Indian Act is. A lot of people in Canada don't know what the Indian Act is unless they're impacted by it.
Mm-hmm.
The Indian Act essentially is the policy created by Canada and how it was going to deal with its Aboriginal or Indigenous population. And the Indian Act was also a model that was used by the South African government under apartheid. And so there were changes that were made to the Indian Act that lowered the requirements for the numbers of people required, percentage of the tribe, required to approve or vote on the dispossession of their lands.
Mm-hmm.
And so all that's required is for them to say, okay, we have a tribe of 600 people. We need, you know, a certain percentage. That means we only need to find, you know, 60 people that will say, yeah, you can have my land for some money.
Right.
And so it, you know, it doesn't need to be with the consent of the people. You know, it's just, it's a lower threshold. And then what happens is that makes that land alienable. So the communal rights that they have as a tribe are gone. And so individuals that sign the land away then have the right to sell that off as individuals. There's no more protections for those lands. And so by lowering those thresholds without any discussion with the Indigenous peoples of Canada, without the approval of the Indigenous peoples of Canada, no free, prior, and informed consent, because you can't have that without proper consultation. Consultation is not sitting down in a meeting and saying, this is what we're going to do, okay, and then leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Consultation is meaningful, face-to-face dialogue where both parties are equally represented, where both parties have an equal voice at the table and an equal amount of power.
Right.
That's not the case. What you have is you have the AFN, which is the Assembly of First Nations, and then you have the Atlantic Policy Congress, and you have this group of chiefs that are not consulting with their people,
mm-hmm.
that are in many cases directly opposing the wishes of the people and signing these agreements. And, you know, the people are... they're literally starving for justice up there. There's no other way to say it. You have new hunger strikes that are going on right now with a number of people, including young mothers,
mm-hmm.
who are just, they don't know what else to do to bring attention to the fact that the future of their children is being taken from them. Their way of life is being destroyed. They're, you know, and it's all so that these lands can be handed over to industry.
Right.
And so, you know, that's, there's this this development plan that came across my desk that shows this movement from the western part of Canada over to the Atlantic and down through Maine. And using that, because there was so much pushback in the western United States about bringing those pipelines down through the western United States, that they said, that's okay, we can just go east.
Mm.
And so that was approved. The east to the west to east pipeline across Canada was approved. And so in its path came those two pieces of controversial legislation, which are only representative of the most recent attacks. This is an ongoing, systematic, like you said, ethnic cleansing. You know, it's genocide,
mm-hmm.
Of the peoples. And so the laws that were included in there touch on nearly every aspect of the lives of the people, the Indigenous peoples up there, but they also dismantle more than 70 federal environmental laws.
Is that right?
Yeah, and so there's a deregulation, there's a condition in there that allows for the Transportation Secretary or the equivalent of the Transportation Secretary in Canada to essentially rubber stamp projects without them having to go through any type of proper environmental assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're going across Canada, and then they're supposed to come down through Maine. And so the projects coming into Maine are the East-West Corridor. And there's also a pipeline that goes down through, a 60-year-old pipeline that goes down through kind of down through the western part of the state into Portland, Maine, there's a 27 million gallon pressurized gas tank that's being pushed in the town of Searsport off the coast of Maine in Penobscot Bay.
Wow.
Which, if there was an explosion of that tank, it would take out the whole central coast area. It would be the equivalent of like a 15 kiloton nuclear bomb going off. The people are opposed. There's a five-panel group of selectmen who get to decide. Their independent consultant that they had do the studies on that was actually an employee of the company who is pushing the project, who took a leave of absence to be a private consultant do the work. And so, you know, this is part of a long-term energy development plan. And, you know, it really makes us wonder, there's been an attack against the tribe, the Penobscot Nation, in regard to their water rights, their ability to manage the waterways in the Penobscot River, which surrounds all of our lands.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us believe that that's a preemptive strike, that they're trying to deregulate that waterway because they're planning to bring that east-west highway right across tribal land, right across the Penobscot River. And so in order to be able to do that, and we suspect their long-term plan is to run a pipeline across there, then they need to get the tribes out of the way. So we believe that this attack on the tribe's sovereign right to manage its own waterways is simply a preemptive strike by these energy development companies to pave the way for them to do whatever they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so there's this piece of legislation that got passed related to these public-private partnerships, PPPs, and what's going on with those public-private partnerships is that they're stating that because there's a certain percentage of private funding, and the private funders are not disclosed, that those projects are exempt from the Freedom of Information Act.
Mm-hmm.
So people can't get any information on the projects that are going on. The Maine legislature passed this under LePage's administration. LePage's big thing has been Maine is open for business.
Mm.
And what that really has meant is that Maine is for sale to these energy development companies because he's approved open pit mining for Irving, all kinds of extremely destructive energy practices in the state of Maine that are going to destroy the real value of the state of Maine, which is its environment. And so this east-west corridor is part of its plan was to get the passage of those public-private partnership agreements in the legislature. And so they got that passed, which means that they don't have to disclose what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that means in legal terms is that once is it, you know, a mechanism that allows for companies, once they've invested a certain amount of money, that people can't stop them because it would not be equitable because they've invested so much already in the project. And so this prevents people from being able to interfere with their plans and to stop them from doing what they are planning to do because there's no right of access to any of the information regarding the project. So nobody knows what stage the project is in. And so literally, the public ways are, you know, being sold off to these private companies who are going to come in here, make a ton of profit, completely destroy the main ecosystem, and then they're going to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And they're investing in energy practices that are quickly becoming outdated. They're not sustainable. This isn't a long-term profitable venture for the state of Maine. It's a short-term come in, rape the earth, and leave prospect for these companies. And then Maine will be left with all of the mess. And so it's the same across Canada. I just was up there last weekend meeting with people from a number of tribes in Canada, and one of them was saying that they allowed a fracking field right on the edge of their land, and that 31 people in that community have died in the past year from cancer, very aggressive forms of cancer, because mm-hmm. that they're not required to release information about the chemicals that are being used in the fracking process. So you have more than 40,000 gallons of highly pressurized water and these fracking chemicals being injected into the earth, which seeps into the water table in the area. There's no containing. There's no way for them to contain it. They say they have these containment pools, but that's for the stuff that's pumped back out.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for the stuff that's pumped into the ground. And so, you know, it's making the water poison for all of the people that are living in the surrounding area. And so that's where it becomes really clear to anybody paying attention that there is an undeniable nexus between indigenous land rights, environmental justice, and human survival.
Right.
This is no longer just an indigenous issue, the taking of our lands, because inevitably those lands will end up in the hands of industry, because indigenous lands are some of the only untouched lands remaining.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the energy resources still lie.
Right. And so the protection of indigenous lands really is now a human problem. It's an issue of human survival on this planet because we have a finite amount of water. And so the industry that's coming through here is the most destructive type of resource extraction industry that we've ever seen. In fact, fracking is outlawed pretty much everywhere in the world other than the United States and Canada.
Right.
And that's because it's so dangerous. Not only is it dangerous because of the chemicals that leach into our groundwater, but it's also dangerous because these containment pools have unstable elements in them that are believed to be linked to major earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then you have tar sands extraction, and there's a NASA scientist, I believe his name is James Hansen, who's been arrested a couple of times because he recognizes and has been very vocal about the fact that tar sands extraction is a game over proposition for human life on this planet. It's that destructive. And so to have those types of practices be allowed in some of the most pristine places on the planet, you know, across the U.S. and Canada, these are really crimes against humanity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's gotten to that point. And so that makes the work that we do, because we don't have very many resources. Most of us volunteer. Well, pretty much everybody volunteers their time to do this work. And the only resources that we've had come in have been very, very small, and they've essentially covered some expenses. But, you know, it's a real David and Goliath story, because you have these energy companies that have the option of being very patient and just shoveling as much money into this as is required to buy the local governments, to, you know, take their time to put people in place in the legislature to vote the way that they need them to vote,
mm-hmm.
and to do whatever they can, because they have unlimited amounts of money.
And that's what's backing this unbridled devastation.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, we're running out of time. I want to thank you for laying all this out. Any closing thoughts you'd like to leave us with, and what we should be keeping our eye on?
Well, I think that one of the things that is really important, the most important part of all of this, is for people to really realize that the protection of indigenous lands, as I stated, is no longer an indigenous issue. It really is an issue of human life. And that there's no longer time to simply keep your eye on something. It's time for action. The people who have been waiting for the 11th hour to jump in and to help save the planet, this is the time. You know, we literally are in the 11th and a half hour, and we really need all people to stand up, because if we don't have water, there will be no life on this planet. It doesn't matter how much money you have.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's the bottom line, is that these issues are now about human survival.
That's right. Thank you so much.
Yep.
Sherry Mitchell with the Land Peace Foundation. I appreciate you being on the show and talking to us about these really crucial and critical issues. Mahalo nui loa.
Thank you, Kehlani.
We'll be in touch. And again, listeners, that was Sherry Mitchell, the executive director of the Land Peace Foundation. And we'll be back on Indigenous Politics right after this public service announcement.
My Lakota na ia waslo and mataha. I'm Lakota and I'm from Standing Rock.
And I've got asthma. Mom, Dad, Grandma, Grandpa, I know that you do all that you can to help me. But you might not know about all the different stuff that can make me have an asthma attack. Or all the simple things you can do to fight my asthma. Please don't smoke in the house or the car, because secondhand smoke triggers my asthma attacks. If you put my teddy bear in the freezer, it will wipe out the dust mites. And if you dry off my rubber duckies and bath toys, you will get rid of mold. All the things that can cause an attack.
These are just a few of the many things you can do to help your child fight their asthma attacks. To discover other simple ways to prevent an asthma attack, call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. A public service message brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Because I don't want to feel like a fish with no water.
My name is Florence AQ. For lunch today, I had grilled chicken and squash. I am Zuni Indian, and I have the power to prevent diabetes.
My name is D. Dakota Denesosi. I turned the TV off and took my nieces and nephews for a walk. We saw two jackrabbits, an eagle, and zero cartoons. I'm from the Dene Nation, and I have the power to prevent diabetes.
Science has proven that if we lose as little as 10 pounds by walking briskly for 30 minutes, 5 days a week, and make healthier food choices, we can prevent diabetes.
My name is Barbara Akasakup Curtis. I'm losing weight and being more active. I am Alaskan Inupiaq Eskimo, and I have the power to prevent diabetes.
For more information on how to prevent diabetes, talk to your healthcare provider. For free materials, call the National Diabetes Education Program at 1-800-438-5383 and ask for the power to prevent diabetes. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
And we're back here on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. Now let's turn to the second part of the show. As I mentioned earlier, Boston University Law School will be hosting a conference on the Palestinian right of return. Speaking to us now, we have two of the conference organizers, Jamil Sbet-An and Zina Ozir. Jamil is a Palestinian student at Boston University and is a member of its Students for Justice in Palestine chapter. Zina is in her last year of studies at Boston University, completing her bachelor's degree in international relations and Arabic. She is the president of Boston University's Students for Justice in Palestine. And they join me by telephone from Boston. Greetings, Jamil and Zina. Are you on the line?
Yes.
We're here.
Jamil here.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. It's a pleasure to have you both on the show to talk about this important work you're doing at Boston University Law School. Could you start by telling our listeners a bit about your background and also how you came to do this work as student activist? Jamil?
Thank you for having us. I come from a Palestinian family, some of which has been displaced in 1948, and others who have left later on. And so having that background, I always had been aware of the Palestinian cause and was always sympathetic to it, especially as my family had been continuously glued to the television whenever something happened, whenever some drastic event happened. And bearing that history, I had always been meaning to get involved in some way in this work. And so when I first got to college at Boston University, I joined Students for Justice in Palestine. Ever since then, since freshman year, I've been heavily involved in this work, and I'm very passionate about it.
Okay, thank you. Yes, and I remember when you hosted me to speak with Students for Justice in Palestine at Boston University, you had an incredibly diverse group within the Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP.
Yes, we have people coming from a variety of backgrounds and perspectives, and it really adds to our message and to our cause.
Mm-hmm. And Zina, would you tell us a bit about yourself, too?
Sure. So I'm Lebanese-American, and I grew up in Dearborn, Michigan, which is kind of infamous for its concentrated Arab-American population. And so growing up in that environment and my family being from southern Lebanon, I grew up being aware of the role that Israel played in the Middle East, especially in Lebanon, and they were occupying southern Lebanon until 2000 and the 2006 war, so I had always been aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And remember going to protests and things like that as a child with my family, and growing up in a pretty politically active family. I grew up being aware of what was happening in Palestine, and like in middle school worked for the Middle East Children's Alliance, which is an organization that gives aid to Palestinian children. And when I got to Boston University, I think about my sophomore year, I got involved with Students for Justice in Palestine and have been working with them since then. And this is my last year there. So it's been a long road of kind of being involved with Palestinian politics peripherally, and then in the past couple of years, way more involved. And I went to Palestine this past summer, was in Bethlehem. So that's pretty much the scope of my experience.
Yes, that's excellent. Thank you both for giving us a point of entry into how you come to do this political work while undergrads at Boston University. This is work that certainly puts you in a particular position in terms of, you know, controversy over the conference itself, which I don't think should happen, but obviously with this being such a contentious issue around Palestine solidarity work, it is risky business, so to speak, and it's certainly very important. For our listeners, this is an Indigenous Politics show. Before we jump into the actual parameters and sort of scope and aims of the Palestinian Right of Return Conference that I want to ask you about and what, you know, had you decide to organize this, I want to know if you could just give our listeners some insights as to how you understand the Palestinian situation as an Indigenous issue. And also, Jamil, you mentioned that your own family was displaced in 1948. Listeners, of course, this is the year that Israel established itself as a state on Palestinian lands, and we have the entire history of ethnic cleansing and removal of the Nakba. Jamil, could you speak to some of that history? And then, if you want to speak to some of the issues around indigeneity.
So, in 1948, when Israel established itself, about 750,000 Palestinians have been either forced out or had to flee due to the attacks by various Zionist militia groups. And from my own family history, my grandmother, who grew up in Ramle, which is now inside Israel, had to flee her home and was never allowed to return. Her family had to go to Ramallah, where she spent the rest of her childhood years. And she would always reflect back on, her house, her life in Ramallah and in Ramle, and would always tell the story of when her and her family visited a number of years later, and with her mom clutching the key while an Israeli family had now settled in the house, and her not being able to get into the house anymore. So this had always been a powerful story for me, especially. In doing this work, I always reflect back on the story specifically, as it's a particularly poignant one for me. The specific depopulation of Palestinians in 1948, which continued in 1967 and continues today through various modes of ethnic cleansing, is endemic to kind of ideology of Zionism, which deems the Palestinian population as merely a demographic threat, which can be easily removed from their lands in order to establish a Jewish majority state.
Mm-hmm. And so this is really, you're giving an overview of what occupation looks like in the nitty-gritty, right? We're talking about not just military occupation, but literally occupying individual homes. This is door-to-door displacement.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not simply an establishment of a different government administration. It's taking over people's livelihoods and destroying people's ways of life that had been existent before, especially with what had been what is known now that about 70% of Palestinian villages in Israel have been completely wiped out.
And it's not unlike the forced Indian removal in the U.S. in the early 19th century of the tribes in the southeast being forcibly removed to what is now present-day Oklahoma, then known as Indian Territory. And yet this happened in the mid-20th century, post-World War II.
Right. Yeah, and what's ironic about the situation is that Israel very much frames itself as a post-colonial state.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, you know, it terms the 1948 establishment of the state as established through a war of independence, whereby they imagine themselves as having fought an anti-colonial struggle against the British. But the British Empire had been disintegrating, and they, having lost their power, they had to leave and leave it up to the UN. And the UN partitioned Palestine, but the Zionists did not go by this partition and went way over
mm-hmm.
and took over way more land than had been allocated.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be said that also, just because the UN had partitioned the land, it wasn't for the UN to give away, and it wasn't for the Zionists to take.
Right, and also this, again, echoes this anti-colonial struggle against the British. That's what white Americans here did, right? Again, subordinating Native nations, removing them, and then expropriating their land for themselves, right? So we're
right.
dealing with a colonial situation in both cases,
exactly.
Settler colonialism and military occupation. Zena, would you like to speak to any of these issues of indigeneity and comparative perspective?
Sure. I think I might speak more to how when you first enter thinking about Israel-Palestine, that it's not always the perspective you're looking at it through, and I definitely didn't enter Palestine solidarity issues with the understanding of settler colonialism or colonialism or Palestinians as indigenous, because a lot of times we are told that this is a situation, this is a conflict between two equal sides, and it's a situation that you have to dialogue through and talk about and not take sides. And so I think that really complicates the issue, especially for people outside of the scope of understanding of what actually happened and the history of it. And I think that really makes it hard for people to relate that to indigenous politics and actually what kind of displacement happened and the situation that Palestinians live in now. And I'll echo what Jamia said about the British, is that really complicates the picture of indigeneity and of colonialism, because the Zionists were really able to make it seem as though they were the indigenous population fighting against this colonial power. And I think that during the early and mid-20th century, that this was a very effective tactic, is to approach it from that lens of saying, well, we are the native population. Nobody existed here before we did, and therefore we have the right to defend ourselves against this colonial power, which was the British occupying forces. And so I think that you have to think about Palestinians as a group of people that are indigenous to that area, and that Zionism was created, in fact, to to create a homeland that was already inhabited.
That's right. Now, Jamil, you mentioned that 750,000 Palestinians were forced out or had to flee. Could you, either one of you, give an overview of the Palestinian refugee situation today in 2013 and the diaspora? And then let's get to what prompted you to take on this conference organizing. I mean, I actually want to talk about what is the right of return for Palestinians. We usually only hear that concept in relation to Judaism and Jewish people.
After being forced to flee or having been forced out, Palestinian refugees had to leave to surrounding Arab countries in which refugee camps had been established for them. Or had to establish refugee camps, and which had eventually been taken over by UN bodies for services. And so Palestinian refugee camps are found in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Syria, And but even though Palestinian refugees inhabit these places, they often happen to be a minority of them who inhabit the refugee camps.
Mm.
The majority of Palestinian refugees don't inhabit the refugee camps and are dispersed all over the world, in Latin America, in the U.S., in Europe, everywhere. And but speaking particularly to the refugee camps, their situation is particularly deplorable. They had been stripped of their former livelihoods, even if they were livelihoods which were, you know, simple, based on farming and, you know, agrarian lifestyle. They're very much nostalgic for this form of lifestyle, particularly the older generations who are nostalgic, and the younger generations who idealize this lifestyle that they had before they had been forced out of their homeland, and now forced to rely on these international bodies where their lives are basically in a precarious situation, where their categories are constantly changing from the UN Relief Works agency to the U.S., which last summer Senator Mark Kirk tried to change the status of Palestinian refugees to only include those that had been directly displaced in 1948,
mm-hmm.
trying to strip away funding, U.S. funding for the UNRWA, which would lead to a catastrophe in terms of these people's livelihoods and survival. Having personally visited some of these refugee camps in Jordan and having interviewed some of these families that live there, they very much hold on to their right to return to their homeland, even, you know, 64 years later. And what I found really surprising was that it's not only the older generations who want to return, it's the younger generations as well, particularly the second generation, who feels especially passionate about returning. Some of them told me, like, even if they painted Jordan gold, they wouldn't stay here and would prefer to go back and rebuild their villages and their homes. So it's very much intrinsic to the Palestinian cause, this struggle to return to the homeland, even if they had been integrated or settled somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yes. A year ago, I had the opportunity to go to Ida refugee camp, and I noticed that there's just this massive key at the entryway, and also, you know, murals of UN Resolution 194 saying that Palestinians have the right to return. And I'm also just thinking about time that I spent very briefly at Shatila refugee camp in Beirut, in Lebanon, and Uma Hassan, an elder that we met, talking about being forcibly removed with her grandparents. And here we were sitting in her home that had been blown to bits and rebuilt twice due to Israel military encroachment and devastation, sitting there in the home with her and her grandkids and thinking about the multiple generations affected by this 1948 ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. Certainly, this is a question of intergenerational trauma, and just
right.
thinking through in terms of all the different generations affected, and that would certainly have implications for the way that the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, also known as UNRWA, mm-hmm. defines who counts as a Palestinian refugee. How are you mm-hmm. taking that up in the conference?
So there are presenters who are going to be speaking about generational issues and about Palestinians with third country citizenship, such as in the United States and in the Gulf countries and other places where they have settled, including, for example, my family, who does have citizenship in other countries. And so we are trying to address this issue in the conference by trying to understand what these generational demands are and where does the diaspora who have citizenship in other countries fit into the project of the right of return.
Mm-hmm. Zina, would you like to add anything to that in terms of how you came to be co-organizing this conference and some of the questions at hand for the goals?
Oh, sure. So getting involved in the conference was very much, we kind of went on a whim, and Jamil had the idea from going to a lecture where the speaker actually said, oh, you all should plan the Right of Return conference. And so he brought that back to the group, and I was really excited about the prospect of that. And then later found out that in 2000, there was a right of return conference at Boston University held in the law school. And so we were really motivated to try to recreate what had happened in 2000 at this conference, because it was kind of a groundbreaking conference. And I think the right of return is one of the most contentious tenets of like Palestinian self-determination. And I think that it's very important to address the issue of return, and that it's something that is talked about a lot, especially among refugees. And I was similarly in Ida camp last summer, and the memory of the villages that the refugees are from is very integral to their identity. And I think that it's a really important factor and a really important part of Palestinian identity. And so I think that when you talk about Palestinian struggle, you have to also talk about and the right of return. So I think that's the angle that I came to this from. And we were excited to reach out to academics to submit papers for the conference, and we're really impressed by what we got back. And like, we're going to be looking at Palestinian identity and collective memory and geography and mapping and space, and looking at how return can actually be implemented, and not just think about it theoretically and if it's possible, but how it can happen. So we're not asking if return is possible, but how it can happen, and like what actual steps must be taken to implement the right of return for Palestinians. And I think that's a big part of the conference, and what our goals are and what our vision is for the conference, is that we're not asking if right of return is possible. This is something that we believe is a right for Palestinian refugees. But what we're doing with the conference is getting academics to actually, who have done the research, to tell us how right of return can be implemented through counter mapping and through different governmental like help and implementation of this return. So I think that's a really important part of what we're doing with the conference.
Yes, very important. Listeners, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond with your host, Kehaulani Kawanui. And I'm on the phone with Jamil Spit-Un and Zina Ozir, who are on the line from Boston University. They are organizing the Right of Return Conference, that is the Palestinian Right of Return Conference, that will take place at the Boston University Law School Auditorium on April 6th and 7th this year, 2013. Zina, I just want to go back to something you said. You mentioned that the Palestinian Right of Return is one of the most contentious tenets of Palestinian self-determination. And I do want to just highlight that for a second. We only have a few minutes left. So many people, you know, if they're willing to critique Israel at all, they often only go so far as to really challenge the 1967 borders and the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, without actually being willing to often look at the refugee situation and the Palestinian right of return. And then the third prong, or the third tenet, which is about the rights of Palestinians living in 1948, right? And so I just want to point that out for listeners who might be unfamiliar with this, sort of the broader kind of scope around Palestinian self-determination. We're talking about at least three distinct sort of Palestinian populations here: those in the 48, those who are refugees and in the diaspora, and those in the occupied territories. We're almost out of time, but I just want to invite you to leave us with any concluding comments around the implications. I mean, I think this is obviously, your conference committee certainly seems to be motivated by a sense of urgency, and I really appreciate that you're taking this on in a way that's envisioning and imagining and planning. Any closing comments around the ethical implications and the practical implications of the right of return and the rights fulfillment?
So just to reiterate what Zaina was saying, I think the discourse has been stuck, you know, is it ethical for Palestinians to return? Is it not ethical? Some have alluded to that this will end up in a destruction of Israel. Such sensationalist comments that have been coming up lately. And I think the sense of urgency we have for this conference is that this is not what we should be talking about, that this discourse is not going to be conducive towards a just solution. And so what we seek in this conference is to open up a platform to plan and try to implement and try to think of the ways that, you know, the burgeoning boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign against Israel could help in facilitating Palestinian self-determination and Palestinian return to our homeland. And I think that's essentially the impetus for having this conference. And I was saying that it was inspired by a speaker I had seen. It was actually Judith Butler, who had been speaking at Tufts, who said in passing, you know, imagine what it would be like if you were to have a right of return conference. Imagine the kind of opposition you would get. But it's really striking that we would get such strong opposition to a conference that's planning to implement self-determination and human rights for everyone, Palestinians, Israelis, everyone living within that land, and everyone who has legitimate claims to live in that land.
Closing thoughts, Zina, and also I want to be sure to leave our listeners with the website URL so they can look at more information about the conference.
So I think that what this conference will do is really open up roads to talking about Palestinian right of return and kind of normalize that conversation. And I know normalization is usually used in terms of normalizing the discussion about the conflict in between Palestinians and Israelis. But for us, we really hope to normalize the right of Palestinians to return to their homelands. And so I think that that is the biggest goal of the conference, and that definitely is one of my biggest driving forces in being involved in this conference. And that we're doing this in an academic setting, and what's really exciting about this is that all of the scholarship that is being put into Palestinian right of return. So it was really, we got tens and tens and tens of submissions for the conference on right of return and Palestinian right of return. So it really gives me hope to when looking at the U.S. academic setting and even outside of the U.S. academic setting, that people are really looking into ways that Palestinians can return to their homelands and thinking about the right of return. So I really think that the conversation is shifting a little bit in the United States, and I think that that's really exciting, and I think that we need to take advantage of that as much as possible and really push with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. So I feel hopeful, and I know that we're going to get a lot of backlash from this conference, but I think that any publicity is good publicity in terms of the Palestinian cause.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Jamil, would you leave us with the URL for the website?
Yes, it's rightofreturn.net.
.net. Okay, rightofreturn.net. Listeners, for those wanting more information, again, for the Palestinian Right of Return Conference that will take place at the Boston University Law School Auditorium on April 6th through 7th this year, 2013. Thank you so much both for joining me on the call today. You're doing brave and very necessary work, and you inspire me so much.
Thank you.
Yeah,
mahalo.
Thank you so much for having us.
We'll be in touch. Aloha.
You've been listening to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond with your host, Kehaulani Kawanui. This show is syndicated through the Pacifica Audio Network and airs on the following stations I'd like to thank: KUCR in Riverside, California, WAZU in Peoria, Illinois, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, WETXLP in the Tri-Cities region of Tennessee, Virginia, and North Carolina, WNJR in Washington, Pennsylvania, WGDR and WGDH in Plainfield, Vermont, WJSC in Johnson, Vermont, WBCR in Plymouth, New Hampshire, and WBCR-LP in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And in closing, I'd like to leave you with a Farouz song. It's titled, We Will Return One Day, about the Palestinian right of return. And for those of you unfamiliar with her, she is a Lebanese singer who is one of the most admired and listened to in the Arab world. Thank you for tuning in. Mahalo. ونغرق في دافئة المنى سنرجع مهما يمر الزمان وتنأى المسافات معنا
وناس الحنين مكان